and this talk. I should explain that I'm not a physicist. I took physics courses in high school and in undergrad, and I enjoyed them and I did well in them, but my career path led me in a different direction. And since graduate school, my sort of only point of contact with physics has been via non-commutative geometry and quantum algebra, which are subjects that fascinate me, but they fascinate me because of the definitions. I've always been obsessed with definitions in a way that often drove my professors to distraction. I'd always be asking, what is this axiom for? Why do we need this? Why do we need that? And trying to get a better picture. And usually mathematicians hate this. And they say, just learn the definition, get used to it, and deal with it, But that's never been, I think, that's never been an acceptable idea to me, and I hope maybe here I get a little bit of sympathy, because I think it's very analogous to what happens between experimental physicists and theoretical physicists, this attitude of don't try to understand these things, just learn to deal with them, calculate with them, and not worry about sort of what's really going on. And it's not an attitude that I accept. I think it's basic human need to understand things and profitable in the long run. One of the books that influenced me the most when I was an undergrad was Calculus on Manifolds by Spivak, commonly known as Baby Spivak. I'm sure you're probably familiar with it. He says, it's a tiny little book where he develops all of the definitions and lemmas that you need in order to have a one-page proof of the generalized Stokes theorem. And after he proves the generalized Stokes theorem, he goes on a little bit of a rant, and he says, there's three things you need to understand, there are three things you should remember from this proof. One is that this generalized Stokes theorem is essentially a triviality. Secondly, it's a triviality because we had the right definitions. We set everything up right, and then it became simple. And the third thing is, just because it's trivial doesn't mean it's not important, right? A triviality can have important consequences. And so that's always been my attitude in rebuttal to this attitude that you should never sort of bother trying to understand things. And anyways, so I've always been fascinated by definitions, and I'm particularly, and let me just sort of say some of the things we're going to be talking about here today. I mean, non-commutative geometry is obviously an umbrella term for several different subjects. You have the theory of C-star algebras, which is held to be a form of non-commutative topology. W-star algebras, which correspond to non-commutative measure theory. And some more stuff, which I'm not going to be talking about so much today, where you have analogs of manifolds and other further things. And in quantum algebra, well, the main things you have are typically Hopf algebras, which are Well, I can't say non-commutative groups because groups are normally non-commutative. So, I mean, these are the quantum groups which are supposed to encapsulate the strange sort of quantum symmetries. And also the modules of Hopf algebras, which are supposed to correspond to linear representations. Of these quantum groups. Now, so I should, at this point, actually, I want to make a bit of an ad for two pieces of research I've already done. The main point of this talk is research that I haven't yet done, but it's a project that I plan to be working on. And so I guess I should say just a little bit about what these are first. So in particular, so one oddity that would strike someone like me when I look at this first picture is the fact that every W star algebra is a C star algebra. And so, but it's not the case that every measure space sort of is a topological space. And this is sort of an odd, this strikes one as a bit odd. And in fact, this sort of brings you to wonder in what sense is measure theory really a subset of topology? And actually, there's a surprisingly good answer to this question. I actually worked this out about 5 years ago, but I've promised many times to publish it, but it's one piece of work that sort of always gets ignored in favor of other things, because in some ways it's a bit easy, actually. This is something which, this connection is actually very simple, but except it hinges on understanding something called locale theory. And once you have that, then this becomes sort of very natural. The other thing, the second ad I want to make, and this is for a paper that I'm almost finished. It's really sort of, I actually hope to have it on the archive before the end of the year, was inspired about a year ago. I was working at the University of Edinburgh in the computer science department, and Prakash Panangadan came to visit and gave a 4-hour lecture on quantum computing to a mixed audience of physicists, mathematicians, and computer scientists. And he was reviewing some of this idea, some of the ideas here about how linear representations of classical groups can be understood as modules. Again, the classical picture, how they're understood as modules over for the group algebra. And then he sort of stopped that and then started talking about unitary representations. And the whole rest of the talk was about unitary representations. And that, again, sort of struck a chord with me. And I thought, well, what's the good of all this if you're only talking about linear representations, when at the end of the day, what you're sort of really wanting to talk about are unitary representations? And so I fiddled around with it a bit, and I realized that I could define something which I call a Dagger-Hopf algebra, which is sort of, it's only a small tweak on the normal definition of a Hopf algebra. But when you have a Dagger-Hopf algebra, then it makes sense to consider Hilbertian modules on it. And these Hilbertian modules are going to correspond to unitary representations. So in particular, the Hermitian modules of a group algebra are going to be just correspond to the unitary representations of this thing. And this is not actually, as I said, these are just ads for two pieces of mathematics that I have done already, and where thinking about definitions can really sort of lead to some interesting results. But actually, what I'm going to be talking about today is how to get to non-commutative geometry from topos theory. I think you maybe also can get quantum algebra from topos theory too, but actually I just want to focus on this one direction at the moment. So now I should say a bit about topos theory and what topos theory is. Now this is a notoriously difficult task. There's a story. So there's a Hindu proverb which is often told in connection with topos theory, and it goes like this: four men who had been blind from birth wanted to know what an elephant was like, so they asked an elephant driver for information. He led them to an elephant and invited them to examine it. So one man felt the elephant's leg, another its trunk, another its tail, and the fourth its ear. Then they attempted to describe the elephant to one another. The first man said, "The elephant is like a tree." "No," said the second, "the elephant is like a snake." "Nonsense," said the third, "the elephant is like a broom." "You are all wrong," said the fourth, "an elephant is like a fan." And so they went on arguing amongst themselves while the elephant stood watching them quietly. And this proverb was first quoted by André Joyal in connection with topos theory, because to explain this sort of very curious history of topos theory and also the way in which it's very difficult to say what it really is. So just from a purely historical perspective, toposes were first invented by French algebraic geometers, most notably Grothendieck, and basically Grothendieck and his collaborators. And this was sort of in the 60s. And Grothendieck was working on proving the Weil conjectures, which are sort of mod p analogs sort of collectively form a mod p analog of the Riemann hypothesis, and as he was studying this, he realized there was the sort of conventional notion of topological space wasn't good enough for his purposes. And he needed something more general. He needed a generalized topological space. And so they introduced toposes as a generalized notion, as a generalized notion of topological space. In fact, and the name topos refers to this. Grothendieck says quite explicitly that really topology should be defined as the study of toposes. Right? That's the name topos is chosen to suggest that. So you have this notion of topos, and you also have an associated notion of geometric morphism, which is then to be thought of as the generalized
continuous functions.
So, and in fact, so the point is, in this sort of original conception of topos theory, is that toposes, together with geometric morphisms, form a category sort of extending, which sort of extends and simultaneously replacing sort of the ordinary category of topological spaces. So that's one way of thinking of topos theory. But then it's not the only way of thinking about topos theory. In particular, later, not much later, Levere and Tierney sort of reinvented topos theory in starting about 1970. And Levere's ambition, Levere is an interesting character, and he's not a logician, but he was worried about the standard foundations of mathematics. He did, and he sort of belongs to a long line of dissenters from the usual foundations of mathematics. And he saw topos, he wanted to create a new categorical foundations of mathematics, and he saw toposes as a vehicle for expressing this. And in collaboration with Tierney and others who followed, sort of showed this to be correct. So this gives a second idea of what a topos is. A topos can be thought of as a mathematical universe. It's a category which is sufficiently like a model of ZFC that you can do mathematics inside it. Notice how this is sort of completely different from the Grothendieck perspective of what a topos is. I mean, Grothendieck was amazed and thrilled at what Levere had done. But you have this idea, and then here we look inside a topos, and we see its objects as being like sets, and performing mathematics inside a topos. And this has proved a very fruitful activity. And also, it's worth saying something about the geometric morphisms. So a geometric morphism is an adjunction between two topos, between these two toposes. And what this does, gives a very efficient way of communicating information about one mathematical universe to another. And so this is actually sort of very key to understanding topos theory as a foundations of mathematics, is not just that you're interested in picking one topos, although you can do that, but a lot of topos theory is about understanding how logical information flows around. And I should say just on about the foundational aspects of topos theory. I mean, as I said, Levere comes from a long line of such dissenters, and I think they did the mathematical world collectively a tremendous service, because as Descartes would say, to know anything you must first doubt everything. And I think that starting with Brouwer challenging the law of excluded middle. Whether you like the law of excluded middle or not, you can't help but say that this challenge which was posed to it resulted in a much deeper understanding of what it actually is and what you can do with it and what you can do without it. So yes, it should be explained. It's a mathematical universe, and it, in particular, it has its own, each topos has its own internal logic, which is already non-classical in general. So when you're doing mathematics inside the topos, it's somehow taking this internal logic into account. But this is not the end of the story. In terms of the elephant story, there were four different perspectives on what an elephant is. And here I've given two explanations of what a topos is. But in fact, this is not the end of the story. There are other ways. There are yet further ways you can think about toposes. And the one I'm going to be concentrating on today is the notion of a topos is, as a Morita equivalence class, of localic groupoids. And yes. So again, I'm sort of, instead of saying what a topos is, I should say, by the way, I mean, this is a very unusual talk for me. I'm sure it's also a very unusual talk for you. But I mean, for me, a usual talk would consist of throwing definition after definition after definition after definition at you. It's sort of worse. This is worse than formulas. I mean, this is what mathematicians typically do, is they throw formulas at you like that. But somehow I would do the same, but instead of formulas, it would be definitions. And I just thought, you know, it's actually, and these definitions are typically long, right? And they're not easy to wrap your head around at the first time around. And that's why I thought, it's part of the reason I'm giving a chalk talk today, is because I decided normally the definitions are too long just to write, you know, waste too much time writing them on the chalkboard. So normally I would have slides sort of with definitions. And I just thought, you know what, let me try to give a more sort of big picture talk where I'm afraid I'm being a bit vague here, but as I say, to make it precise is it's not that I can't do it, but I just want to concentrate on the big picture for now. So localic groupoids. Well, firstly, I should say, I mean, what a groupoid is in the first place. So I'll do an example. I think this is, for me, a simple example, which is the fundamental groupoid of a topological space. So normally this is perhaps a useful way of thinking about groupoids. So normally people speak of the fundamental group of a topological space. I assume there's maybe a bit of familiarity with homotopy theory here. And now, the thing is that in order to have, you can only have a fundamental group of a topological space if it's path connected, right? If it's not path connected, then each path connected component, will have its own fundamental group. And so one way of thinking of the fundamental groupoid of a space is by taking these fundamental, all these different fundamental groups, one for each connected component, path connected component, and just putting them side by side. But there's actually a better way of talking about this, which is, so here X is a topological space. And so I define pi 1 of X is, well, so a groupoid is a category. So a category has objects and arrows. So pi 1 of X, the objects of this groupoid are the points of the space. And the arrows are homotopy equivalence classes of points, of paths. So I said here the objects are points. So if I have two points, X and Y, then an arrow from X to Y is actually going to be as the picture sort of suggests, is actually going to be a path from X to Y modulo the homotopy equivalence. And the point is that you can compose them as you normally compose paths, and you can invert them. And this is so the simple definition of what a groupoid is that it's a category in which every arrow is invertible. And that's what we have here. Every path, you could just reverse it, and then that's going to be the homotopy will allow you to squish that down to the identity. Of course, the identity on any point is just going to be the path that doesn't move. Now, and the point is, how does this compare with what I was saying before about taking the disjoint union of the different fundamental groups? Is, well, obviously, two objects of this category are going to be isomorphic if and only if there's a path between them. So the isomorphism classes of this category are really the path-connected components. And if you can imagine sort of, and it turns out this, in the case of ordinary groupoids, this works well, that you can sort of, that every groupoid is a disjoint union of groups. But the point is, you still have, because categories don't need to be connected. And so you can have an object over here and an object over there, and with no arrow between them. And those are sort of accounting for the different components of X. So now we can define a topos isn't a class of groupoids, it's a class of localic groupoids. So now I need to say a little bit about locale theory. I referred to locale theory. I referred to locale theory here when I was talking about how to understand measure theory as a subset of topology. Essentially, locale theory is again, it's an alternative approach to topology where normally when you define a topological space, you start with the set of points. And then you say, certain sets of points are going to be called open. In locale theory, you take this idea of open as basic. In the locale, you don't start with points. Actually, I was speaking about this with Flavio last night after his talk. He got very excited, and he said, in his opinion, the notion of point has done so much damage to physics, actually. And this is the idea in locale theory, is that you have, you, it's a more holistic approach where you you start with this notion, the very abstract notion of open parts, and you just ask that these open parts form a lattice which has certain properties, and that's it. And then you can, then the notion of point is a derived notion, and you can say, does this locale have any points or not? And it turns out that a non-trivial locale might simply fail to have any points. In fact, I can explain that in terms of this. I said I wasn't going to say, but actually I'm. This is such a good example that it's worth doing. The when you have a measure space, you turn this into a W star algebra by calculating the L infinity space. Now, and this is the point. This is the point that that this is a commutative, in fact, also unital. It's a unital commutative W star algebra. Therefore, it's a unital commutative C star algebra. Therefore, it must be continuous functions on some compact Hausdorff space. Now, what is that compact Hausdorff space? It seems very mysterious. But I realized, and in fact, this is an easy exercise to any graduate student who knows anything about locale theory. And that's part of the reason I never got around to publishing it, is because it seemed a bit too easy, was that from this measure space, you can build a locale, which I denote like so. And this is, the points of this locale are, correspond to atoms in this measure space. So if you have an atomless measure space, such as all of our favorite measure spaces, the unit interval or contour space or whatever, then this locale is not going to have any points whatsoever. But it's a non-trivial locale. And in, now, you can, most of what you can do in topology, you can also do in locale theory. And one of the important theorems is that locales have Stoneshek compactifications. So now this is the cute thing, is that I prove is that for, actually there's a technical condition that you can't, if you take, again this is something that's usually buried in textbooks, you can't take a completely arbitrary measure space and get a W star algebra. Normally people restrict their attention to sigma finite measure spaces. In fact, there's a slightly more general condition called localizability. So you have to start with a localizable measure space for any of this to work. But I mean, as I say, you don't get a W star algebra unless the measure space was localizable. But then what you do, what I can do is I can prove that this L infinity space is really the same thing as the bounded continuous functions on this locale. And then by, of course, then by the very definition of Stoneshek compactification, now this is going to be continuous on this, on the Stoneshek compactification of that locale. And so that's how you sort of just, boom, arrive at this concept. Anyways, so my point there was just to emphasize this idea of a localic, well, so a topological groupoid is the same as a groupoid, only you have a topology on the set of objects and a topology on the set of all the arrows, such that all the maps involved become continuous. And this part of the reason why I chose the pi 1x as an example is to see how that's, in fact, a very natural thing to consider. But now when you move to a locale at groupoid, now you don't even have necessarily any objects at all. You just have a locale of objects. If that locale has any points, then you can call those objects of the groupoid. But in general, the objects sort of are in this sort of fuzzy kind of way. You have simply a locale of objects and a locale of arrows, and everything sort of proceeds from there. So now what does any of this have to do with non-commutative geometry? So what I've described to you is that you've got toposes. Toposes can be thought of as Morita equivalence classes of localic groupoids. And Morita equivalence is not an especially coarse equivalence relation. So it sort of varies from context to context. But in this context, it's not an especially coarse relationship. So you should think of a topos as sort of very close to the same thing as a localic groupoid. In fact, the relationship between localic groupoids and topological groupoids is a little bit tortured, except in the locally compact case. This is one of the sort of fantastic things, is that local compactness is a remarkable property. And but you can have among the localic groupoids, you have locally compact groupoids. And among locally compact, of course, you also have one object locally compact groupoids, which are locally compact groups. And one of the sort of signature theorems in functional analysis is that locally compact groups admit a unique Haar measure up to scalar multiple. This Haar measure, one of the things that this Haar measure allows you to do is it allows you to build a non-commutative C star algebra. And people have worked out an analogous, there was again a Frenchman called Jean Reynaud who worked out an analogous theory for locally compact groupoids. Now it turns out here, the existence of a Haar measure, actually he says Haar system, it's the analog of a Haar measure in the groupoid case, does not come for free. It's an extra piece of structure that has to be assumed. So, but if you have a locally compact groupoid with a Haar system, then again, you can turn that into a non-commutative C-star algebra. Maybe I should use a different letter to emphasize that that's a groupoid. And so this is an extra piece of information here, the Haar system. And now what's important to understand is that the C-star algebras, these are mathematically wonderful things, but are they all sort of equally relevant to a physicist, right? So, and I suspect the answer is no. In fact, so you can make, other people have made this case, that the most interesting C-star algebras are precisely these ones that arise from locally compact groupoids. And I mean, as I said, C-star algebras are absolutely fascinating from a mathematical point of view. But for example, there are facts about, in the way of mathematics, there are facts about C-star algebras that depend in very strange, about arbitrary C-star algebras, that depend in very strange ways on set theoretic foundations. So for example, just 2 weeks ago, I happened to be at McMaster University, and there was a set theorist from York University called Ilya Spara, who gave a very interesting talk about how the number of automorphisms of the Kalkin algebra depends on whether the continuum hypothesis is true or not. I mean, and the Kalkin algebra is certainly mathematically sort of a very interesting thing. But sort of, do you really believe that this has anything to do with physics, whether the continuum hypothesis is true or not? And I would much prefer to have a framework where we don't need to worry about such things. And I think that if we just concentrate on the groupoid C-star algebras, then maybe this is not so bad. So what is my project? My project is to understand what this Haar system should mean. So if this Haar system, if I have a locally compact groupoid with a Haar system, then, well, it's also a localic groupoid with a Haar system. And then when I pass to the topos here, what happens to the Haar system there? There must be some sort of Haar structure. I don't know exactly what that Haar structure is yet. This is what I hope to find out. That, and I hope in particular, now, so one thing I hope is that we can build this C-star algebra directly from this information. My second hope is that the Haar structure, again, thinking of a topos as a universe of mathematics with non-classical logic, what does this Haar structure mean from a logical perspective? Can I have a logical understanding of what this Haar structure means? And if so, what does this tell us really about nature? Right? Is there a chance of this? And I should explain why this is a reasonable hope that we have something to do here by returning to the classical case where you just have a locally compact space. So if you have a locally compact space, well, in fact, I think in this case, I'm going to just consider compact spaces. But you have a compact space, X. You can turn this into your C-star algebra, C of X, commutative C-star algebra. But you can also turn it, and this is the sort of very basic first intuition about toposes that Grothendieck had, is that you can turn a topological space into the topos of sheaves on on that space. And this has an internal logic. Now this is again now switching from the Grothendieck style of what a topos is to the Levere style of what a topos is. This topos has a logical structure, and in particular, it has an analog of the natural numbers sitting inside it. Now, so starting with the natural numbers, you can build the integers from the natural numbers. You can build the rational numbers from the integers. So you sort of just proceeding as you do in normal foundations of mathematics, you get to the rationals. Now, getting from the rationals to the reals is much trickier than getting from the reals to the complexes, again, is easy. But the transition from rationals to reals is a bit more difficult, and the set theorists of a century ago or more worked out several equivalent ways of building the reals from the rationals. And it turns out, in the non-classical logic of this topos, these previously equivalent methods of constructing the reals. Now it's more subtle. Now they're not always equivalents. But there's one particular way, which is called the Dedekind Tierney cuts. You have to get, even Dedekind cut splits into Dedekind Tierney or Dedekind McNeil. There's different ways of implementing the idea of Dedekind cuts in the internal logic of a topos. But if you take the Dedekind Tierney complex numbers as built from the internal logic of this topos and pass via the global sections functor to the category of sets, then what you get is precisely this set of continuous functions. So again, you, this idea of passing information from one topos to another. What's better than that is Swan's theorem. So Swan's theorem says that finitely generated projective C of X modules are the same thing as complex vector bundles on X. And complex vector bundles can be thought of as internal vector spaces in this topos over that internal ring. So you have, and of course modules are representations. And so you have this sort of tight information. I think this is, again, and part of my problem with C-star algebras is again the Morita equivalence issue. If two C-star algebras are Morita equivalents, then they're strongly Morita equivalent, I should say, then they're considered to hold the same geometric information. And that's because, I mean, what Morita equivalence boils down to is having the same category of modules. In some ways, I think this is experience of algebraists of, though they're loath to say it so nakedly, but really a ring is just a convenient way of talking about a category, namely its category of modules. When two rings give you the same category of modules, then they're really the same, they represent the same geometric information. And so this is the, so as I say, you really, what you're interested in is not so much the C-star algebra itself as a suitable class of modules for it, say the Hilbert C-star modules for this thing. So, and the point is, so my hope is to sort of really sort of flesh out this picture is that when you pass to, as I say, Hilbert C-star modules for C-star of G, maybe you can get that directly from this topos with this Haar structure. So I should say this topos, the classifying topos of the groupoid, is typically denoted B of G. And I don't know what to call this Haar structure, so I'm just going to call it gamma. And maybe from this pair, consisting of this topos with this, whatever this Haar structure turns out to be, whether I can construct this directly without even thinking first about what the C-star algebra is. As I say, ideally, this Haar structure should mean something logical. It should give me a means of building non-commutative complex numbers inside this topos. And such that the ideally the Hilbert spaces for this object should then be the same as these Hilbert C-star modules, so that you've really got the same amount of information. And as I say, I think that this would be sort of very interesting from, if I'm correct in thinking that this Haar structure is saying something logical, then I think this has really the potential to say something very profound about actually about nature, right? And about what understanding these quantum symmetries, you know, from the perspective of some non-classical logic. So that's it.
Can you explain me why you call your set of morphism geometric in the case of topos? How do you call them geometric? Why?
Okay. It's just that when you think of it turns out there's more than one notion of morphism of topos. There is something called a logical functor between toposes. But the geometric morphisms were invented by Grothendieck in the French algebraic school in such a way that they're meant to generalize continuous functions in precisely this sense, that if I have a continuous function from x to y, then I should get a geometric morphism also from this, the topos of sheaves on x, to the topos of sheaves on y. Now, if I give you that, I can tell you what the definition of a geometric morphism is, but it won't, I don't think it necessarily conveys anything geometric, but the reason for the name geometric morphism is that you have this, and in fact, under very mild separation axioms on k, x, and y, then this is a bijection, that every geometric morphism arises from a continuum. You need some very tiny, tiny separation condition to make the reverse direction also work. But morally, a geometric morphism between topos of sheaves is the same thing as a continuous function between the original topological spaces you first saw. And so that's the justification for the name. Unfortunately, that's it. I'm not responsible for that name. When I invent name, and I do regularly invent terminology, and then you can tell me that that's a bad terminology and I should think of this some other name. But in this particular case, that's almost 50-year-old name, and I'm not in a position to change it.
Okay.
Oh, maybe one thing I can say, though, is that a geometric morphism has an inverse image part. And this inverse image part, from a logical point of view, is terrific. It's sort of the inverse image is preserving everything. And in particular, not quite everything, but the inverse image, the inverse image is particularly powerful. The inverse image of a continuous map is preserving the structure, is preserving the open subsets. But the inverse image of a geometric morphism is preserving much more than that. It preserves models. There's a class of theories which are called geometric theories. Again, there's nothing especially geometric about geometric theories except that they're preserved by inverse image of geometric morphisms. And the point is it's a large class of theories. And so this inverse image is good. I don't know if that's helpful.
Second question, you mentioned that, okay, can you define again your X mu, the localized, or I don't know how, is it a lot? The X mu, first of all.
Yes, okay, so what it means to be localizable,
I just want to know if is it a topological space, something like that?
No, this is a measure space, right? So this is the normal definition of a measure space.
Okay.
Only I've added one extra technical axiom, which is that you see, so let's write M of X for the measurable subsets of X, the sigma algebra that's part of the definition of X. It's a sigma algebra. Inside this sigma algebra, you have the null sets for the measure mu. And that's a sigma ideal. So when you mod out, when you have an algebra and an ideal, right, the natural thing to do is to mod one out by the other. in general, this is going to be countably complete as a Boolean algebra, right? This is a sigma algebra, this is a sigma ideal. In general, this is only going to be a countably complete Boolean algebra. But in fact, and this might be surprising, in fact, if the measure space is sigma finite, then it turns out that this is actually complete as a Boolean algebra. And that is actually the definition of local possibility. This is an old, I need to be a bit careful here. I'm referring to, there's a very old paper by Irving Sigal. It's from 1953 or something like that, where he describes this. And he uses a slightly unusual definition of measure space. I think it was sufficient, 1953 is sufficiently long ago that the sort of definition of measure space hadn't quite been set in stone yet. So he has a definition of measure space that where the infinite parts are sort of, where you only sort of know which subsets have finite measure. That's his approach. And then the sets which have infinite measure, you derive what those are from which sets have finite measure. So he has a slightly different, but in his context, localizable means precisely that this Boolean algebra be complete. And this is the simple fact, is that from a locale theoretic point of view, a complete Boolean algebra is a sufficiently good lattice that I can think of it as the open subsets of a locale. Even though, as I say, and that is this, there's a slightly different notation here. But it's convenient often to distinguish between the locale that you're thinking of geometrically from the lattice, which sort of, in a way, it is. Right? But just that it's convenient to make that notational distinction. But yes, this is the locale corresponding to this lattice. And this is the, as I said, this is, well, it's commonly known as the measure algebra. But when you think of the measure algebra as a locale, you get this somewhat surprising result that the continuous functions from it into the complex numbers give you precisely equivalence classes of measurable functions with respect to the almost everywhere equality thing. And then child's play to say the bounded ones here correspond to the bounded ones there. And so the rest of it is set. But yeah, as I said, this locale, it has its points correspond to atoms of the original measure space. So things that have positive measure, but which can't be subdivided into things of smaller positive measure. That's one thing about Sigal, the definition of measure space that Sigal uses. For example, it excludes the possibility of an infinite atom. So I think because he thinks only of sort of the finite parts. You can fix that up later. There's a remarkable series of books by someone called Fremlin. It's sort of a self-published anthology of measure theory, and it's fantastic, and all the details are written up there. I hope that answers your question.
Should we try to speak here?
Yeah.